Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
With us now, former New York City Police Commissioner Bill Bratton, who, from what I read, is still influential in New York City law enforcement policy as an advisor to Eric Adams. Commissioner Bratton has a new book called The Profession, a memoir of community, race, and the arc of policing in America. Now, for those of you who don't know some of the history, Bill Bratton was first hired by Mayor David Dinkins to be the transit police commissioner when that was a separate force in 1990. The reduction in crime there on his watch led Mayor Rudy Giuliani to hire him as NYPD commissioner in 1994 when he took office. And Mayor Bill de Blasio brought him back again as his first police commissioner during de Blasio's first term beginning in 2014. Not many people can say they were Rudy Giuliani and Bill de Blasio's first choice to do anything. And the New York Times did report the other day that Bratton is now advising Democratic nominee for mayor Eric Adams, who was actually on the transit police back during Bratton's first stint in New York under Mayor Dinkins. The book is both a memoir of Bratton's various stints on the job in New York and elsewhere, and a discussion of the difficult criminal justice issues facing the country today. Commissioner Bratton, thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be with you and your audience this morning. Thank you.
Let's talk about what has become your signature approach to policing, known as the broken windows theory, which you write about at length in the book. For people who have only heard the term used on the news, and maybe loosely or inaccurately, what is broken windows policing according to you who implemented it?
Well, first off, Brian, it is one of the strategies that I employ. It is not the singular strategy. I also employ precision policing, created CompStat back in 1994. Sir Robert Peel in 1829 articulated it best when he defined that the mission of the police is to prevent crime and disorder. 70s and 80s, we focused almost entirely on just dealing with crime and not disorder, and we see where that got us by 1990 in New York. Place was a mess in terms of the quality of life, broken windows issues on the street. So I'm a strong advocate of it, but I'm also a strong advocate of precision policing and the two being used together. It's like a doctor dealing with a patient. He just doesn't deal with this most significant issue or illness, life-threatening, but also all the other illnesses that might impact on the treatment of that serious illness. So for your audience, broken windows or quality of life issues, if you will, are those things in the neighborhood that don't rise to the level of serious crime. The issue of graffiti, the issue of the gang in the corner drinking all hours of the night, the prostitute, the aggressive begging, the homeless issues that are so prevalent in American cities today in terms of all the issues that come with that. The idea is that if you don't control that type of environment, it provides an atmosphere that encourages and supports more significant crime. And we saw that clearly in New York in the 70s and 80s and on the subway system, where quality of life, broken windows types of crime, things that people see every day, even in a high crime city where the risk of being a victim of crime is a 1 in 10, as it was in New York in 1990, every day in 1990, and indeed today in 2021, every New Yorker is exposed to these broken windows. I am a strong advocate that, like a doctor dealing with a patient, you need to focus on not only crime, but disorder. Disorder is another term for broken windows, another term for quality of life crime.
Well, critics these days, as you know, say that approach to policing contributed to mass incarceration of young black and brown men these last 30 years. And I'll just tell the listeners that in the book, you acknowledge that there has been broken windows overreach with things like zero tolerance policies, and that broken windows was never intended to be a high arrest program. So can you elaborate on how a police force focusing on not just crime, but the smaller things you call disorder, can do that without it becoming a high arrest program?
Certainly. It's the idea that you give officers discretion or an oral reprimand, get off the corner, if you will. The idea of moving it up to potential a summons, whether it be a civil summons or a criminal summons, with arrest being the last resort. And the whole stop, question, and frisk issue, which is part of the discussion and the equation of or the equivalency of stop, question, and frisk to broken windows enforcement, they are two separate issues that they are joined in some respects, but they are separate. And the whole issue is the idea of each neighborhood, each city in this country is a different patient. And the challenge for the police is in looking at that patient, listening to the patient, what is ailing you? Is it broken windows types of issues? Is it serious crime? What type of broken windows is bothering the community? Is it the barbecue with 400 people on the corner on a Sunday afternoon? Is it the prostitute on your doorstep? Is it the gang dealing drugs in the local park? These are things the police are asked to respond to. And it is a shared responsibility between police and community as to how much enforcement will be tolerated by the patient. Does it require an admonition? Does it require a summons? Does it require an arrest? And in all instances, what it does require are the three challenges for policing: are to police constitutionally, doing it within the law; police compassionately, dealing with human beings, and you have to deal with them as human beings; and lastly, consistently. And this goes to the issue of disproportionate impact in minority neighborhoods. The idea you cannot police differently in a white neighborhood than you do in a black neighborhood, or in a poor neighborhood versus a rich neighborhood. These are the challenges facing policing. And these are the challenges facing police leaders. When you go to a doctor, you want to go to a very good doctor. Well, when you have a police commissioner, a police chief, or a police captain of the precinct, you want that person to be very good at what they do in terms of diagnosing the ills of their patient.
The incarceration rate for black men in the U.S., according to the statistics website Statista, says more than tripled between 1980 and 2000, from around 1,000 per 100,000 people to around 3,500 per 100,000. Then by 2019, just before the pandemic, it had come about halfway back down to around 2,200 black men incarcerated per 100,000. You were police commissioner here and elsewhere as it was going up and as it was going down. And as it came down, crime was coming down too. So how much does this indicate over-incarceration to you in that period compared to its impact on violent crime?
Well, let's take a look at that. The over-incarceration that is talked about actually began in 1987-88. Laws passed by Congress, supported by the Black Caucus at that time in Congress, to deal with the impact of crime, largely crime around the crack cocaine epidemic. And so there's been a lot of criticism of the 1994 crime bill that President Clinton proposed and signed into law that Joe Biden was very influential in, and something that I advocated and supported. But the mass incarceration that is discussed actually began in the 80s in response to crack cocaine. We have now seen the unintended consequence of some of that legislation, where there were more significant penalties for crack cocaine used more extensively by the black population than the white population, which was using powdered cocaine. And we've attempted to correct that. But I'd point out that in 1996, after I left as police commissioner, I talked about the bell curve impact. That, like a doctor treating a very seriously ill patient, with the crime levels of 1990 in New York City, 5,000 people shot in the streets of New York, 2,243 murder victims, 500,000 serious crimes, the city needed some very serious assertive policing to deal not only with the serious crime, but the totally out of control quality of life on the streets and subways of New York. But we predicted that over time, we would reduce crime significantly and thus reduce the need to arrest, the need to summons, the need to incarcerate. And clearly that in fact happened. My predictions proved true. In 1996, we were had an average jail population of 22,000 at Rikers, and state prison was largely populated by New York City arrests. In 2019, 2020, 2021, and 21, Rikers is now down to about 6,000 or 7,000. The state prison population has been reduced by close to 50%. Why? Because crime and disorder went down dramatically. And even in today's Daily News, I think, district attorney for Brooklyn is touting how crime has been going down in New York in his area in Brooklyn. And he points to the significant decline in crime in 2014 on through the present time. A lot of that was during my time as second time as commissioner, where we did begin pulling back on enforcement fairly dramatically, stop, question, and frisk, summonses, arrests. Why? Because the city was a lot safer. And who ends up benefiting from that? One, many fewer blacks in particular being sent to prison or jail. and many fewer black victims of crime. One of the things that's been lost in this debate and discussion is the victims. And that's something I'm concerned with, I'm first and foremost, and have been for 50 years of law enforcement.
So the good news is, Brian,
we are beginning to reduce over time the prison population as crime went down in America by almost 40% overall. Homicides down by 90%, overall crime by 80%, arrests down dramatically, summonses down dramatically in New York City 2014, 15, 16, 17, 18. Why? Because basically police working with community, embracing community policing, precision policing, and appropriate use of broken windows quality life enforcement made New York City the safest large city in America. And who was benefiting significantly? Well, the minority communities, because there were so many fewer now going to either Rikers or going to state prison.
What was the broken windows overreach that you refer to in the passage from the book that I cited before?
The overreach was very specifically where they tried to basically match up stop, question, and frisk with broken windows enforcement. Stop, question, and frisk is based on the idea of an officer has reasonable suspicion that a crime is, has been, or is about to be committed in his presence. And so he stops a person, he questions a person. He may, if he feels there's a danger to him or to passerby, frisk that person. That's the term frisk. That occurs in about 30, maybe 40% of the cases. The quality of life enforcement issue is separate from that in that it has to do with a lot of other types of minor offenses that don't necessarily rise to the level of a crime being committed. And so the idea is to effectively use the appropriate amount of medicine to deal with the problem. And the appropriate amount of medicine might, again, be the appropriate dose, might be just an admonition. It might be a need for a summons, criminal or civil. And the last resort is arrest. But the idea is that in New York City, from what we were doing in the 1990s, when we had this bell curve where we had to increase arrests, summonses, stops, et cetera, that by 2014-15, when I came back with Mayor de Blasio, we were able to reduce significantly all those activities, including stop, question, and frisk, which had risen dramatically, particularly during Commissioner Kelly's time, up to 2010, when he reversed the policy of pushing for more stops and began to reduce it, so that by the time we came in 2014, I think the stops were down to about 100,000 from 700,000. When I left office in 2016, I think we were down about 10 or 12,000.
Edwin in East Flatbush, who says he's a lieutenant in the NYPD. Hello, Edwin. You're on WNYC.
How you doing, Brian? And good morning, former commissioner. I decided to go into law enforcement primarily because of the way that I was treated as a young black man growing up in a West Indian neighborhood here in East Flatbush, Brooklyn. And upon entering the NYPD, one of the things that was shoved down our throats was the broken windows policing. And immediately I replayed many instances in which anti-crime plainclothes officers, street crime officers, uniform officers embarrassed, mistreated, and over-enforced in my community, even myself being a victim. And now I realize this was what was playing in the background. They were trying to meet their broken windows quotas. Mr. Bratton, I've read The Turnaround. I've read Collaborator Parrish. I haven't read your recent book, but I'm telling you, broken windows is not the way to police in black and brown communities. Broken windows enforcement. You said earlier, as Brian asked, you know, you referenced lower arrest numbers. That's because the late Kenneth Thompson, the district attorney of Brooklyn, chose to not prosecute less than 25 grams of marijuana, which you denounced before Mayor de Blasio made it a citywide initiative. And that's why arrests go down, because when arrests, 60% of the arrests are tied to marijuana, and we change how we enforce marijuana, that's how it goes down. The lower numbers that you keep referencing and that the department leadership likes to reference is a reflection of the work of activists, the work of elected officials, the work of community folks, not the department taking self-corrective action. This is what the leadership of the department has never been able to do, take self-corrective action. It always takes monumental lawsuits, embarrassments, and massive protests. We do not need this, sir. You know, I've studied you. I have some respect for you. One thing you said is you can seriously undermine any organization by putting the right person in the wrong position. And I quote you oftentimes, because you're so right. But what you fail to see is how the department that you were in charge of twice is the paragon of that quote. Broken.
Let me get a response.
It criminalizes entire zip codes for innocuous infractions that occur at higher rates in white areas. It is not.
And you know, Commissioner, that this is a pretty widespread perception. And if we take Edwin at his word, and it sounds like he's talking honestly, he's a lieutenant in the NYPD.
No, and in terms of what he's discussing is not just perception, it's a reality and some of his experiences. And so the challenge going forward is the previous caller. How do you deal with the broken windows complaints that come in from the neighborhood that oftentimes include what he just referenced, marijuana in the public housing developments, the smoking of marijuana in the hallways that we get calls about? So the late deceased district attorney he referenced, who was an extraordinary individual, we had a difference of opinion around the marijuana issue, around the issue of public smoking of marijuana. I have no issues in the sense of use of medical marijuana, no issues in the sense of the increasing use of marijuana in homes, et cetera. But when it's done in a public place, I do have concern for that, because basically looking at the calls that come in to 911, to 311 about people who feel that it's being abused, public housing developments in parks, on city streets. So he makes a lot of valid points, but the idea is that one, I have said it before, I will say it on this show, none of the people I work with, Jimmy O'Neill, now Dermot Shea, many of the leadership of the department, basically endorse or support the issue of quotas. That is widely believed to be the case, however, among the rank and file and indeed supervisors like the lieutenant, that they are being pushed for numbers. No, what I'm pushing for is basically enforcement activity directed against activities which the public is complaining about, whether it's the smoking of marijuana in public. And I might point out that so much of the violent crime that we still see around drug trade issues involves marijuana. It's not cocaine, not heroin, not the hallucinogens. It's around marijuana that we still have a phenomenal amount of violence, a phenomenal amount of calls from the public. And so the challenge for police is how to deal with the multifaceted aspects of that particular issue, particularly in a city and a country that's increasingly legalizing its use.
I want to touch on one more topic before we run out of time, and that's the chapter in your book on counterterrorism. And here we are about to mark the 20th anniversary of the September 11th, 2001 attacks. How do you think the threat of terrorism, be it foreign terrorism or domestic terrorism, has most changed policing in places that would likely be high-profile targets, like New York and L.A. and wherever else?
I speak to that in the book, in those two cities, certainly, that I'm very familiar with, that the sheer amount of resources that we've had to commit and continue to commit in New York and L.A., New York still has almost 1,000 personnel that work full-time on dealing with the terrorism issues, whether it's international, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or the increasing concerns around domestic terrorism from the right and the left. L.A. had, when I was there, created an entity similar in size to New York's, but 300 offices in a much smaller department. So that will continue to be an area of focus for the potential of the disturbances we're seeing around the world, particularly where ISIS and Al-Qaeda seem to thrive, whether it's Pakistan, Afghanistan. And on the home front, clearly the events of January 6th indicate that we have a phenomenal problem. But as recent reporting about the FBI and potential abuse of their investigative tactics in dealing with issues in Michigan point out, that we're going to have to keep a very close eye on what we do in policing, whether at the national level or local level, in dealing with this threat, and to avoid effectively making mistakes while we try to basically avoid having any terrorist incidents. We've done pretty well on the international terrorism front. maybe not as well on the domestic terrorism front, but it's only the last couple of years that we've come to recognize how significant that domestic terrorism issue is, particularly from the far right, and a lot of it that has to do with race and religious issues.
On the international terrorism, in hindsight, is all the local counterterrorism and surveillance strategy keeping us safer, in your opinion? Is it in line with what we want local police departments to be doing? Some say we should leave that to Homeland Security and the federal intelligence community and focus solely on community and neighborhood policing at the NYPD level.
No, it's just basically the reflection of the multiplicity of responsibilities that police have, local police in the 21st century. Prior to the 21st century was crime and disorder. 21st century, we're now dealing with terrorism for the first time. And in large cities like New York and L.A., you have to focus attention there. But we're also having to focus on issues of an exploding drug problem, once again, opioids and others. We're focusing on cybercrime. We're focusing on all of the issues coming out of the internet and social media, increased human trafficking, increased child abuse. The policing challenges, and I talk about this in the book of the 21st century, are phenomenal. And that it's not that crime and disorder are lessening, or terrorism for that matter. They will always be here. They're a part of our lives now. It really is the challenge for American policing. How do you apportion the resources that we have? And the resources are declining. This is why, in terms of this idea of defund the police, you want to defund the police as the responsibilities and challenges are increasing. I'm sorry, just the other way. You want to actually refund the police and spend a lot more money on research, a lot more money on training, a lot more money on legislation that effectively controls the activity of the police so that some of the concerns that the public has can be more effectively addressed.
Bill Bratton, still influential in New York as a former police commissioner, but now advisor to Eric Adams, and author of the new book, The Profession, a memoir of community, race, and the arc of policing in America. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your time. All the best.